This song is St. Louis Blues, one of H. Lee Turner's favorite songs. I'm Shelley, one of Lee's six kids. Here's part two of the interview that Cindy and I did in 1995 with Lee. It starts with Lee explaining more about his jobs on the railroad in high school and college.
Next summer, I started work because there were no men available. Yellow got me on as a brakeman on the Santa Fe. And I skipped the senior or the junior dances and so forth because I was working on the railroad. Now, I worked on the night local. That was the worst job. That was 16 hours a night, 7 days a week. And you averaged about 4 hours sleep, but it made lots of money. You get so tired that you go to sleep standing up and you fall down always when you go to sleep. And I'd be out on the front of a locomotive. You run ahead to throw the switches as a brakeman because you don't want to stop the train. If you stop the train, it takes a long time to get it started up. So you'd run ahead. You crawl out on the end, down on the front. And I remember two or three times during my career where I get down on the front, on the footboard, and fall asleep and fall off. Made very good money. Held seniority when I went to the Army. Everything's seniority on how good the job is.
Now, when you went to the Army, did you fight overseas or did you train in boot camp and stuff and then come home?
No, I graduated in 1945 at the end of World War. Well, World War II was still going on. The Germans had surrendered. But immediately I was drafted and went to basic training. And they were going to train us to go to Japan. And the atomic bomb was dropped, which had the support of 99.9% of the American people. We hated the Japanese for what they had done. The Japanese were brutal people. Everyone supported the dropping of the bomb. Mm-hmm. And that meant I didn't have to go on the invasion of Japan.
But you were a clerk, right, for a period?
No, I went through basic training. As a matter of fact, at Fort Leonard Wood, I was the best shot in Fort Leonard Wood mm-hmm. with the rifle. Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. But remember, in high school, I'd taken typing, mm-hmm. and I typed 88 words a minute on a standard machine. Mm-hmm. And what happens in the Army, or what happened then, all the smart kids get diverted into office work to make the officers, and particularly the generals, a lot easier. Well, immediately, instead of going into, I trained in engineering, but immediately I got diverted into clerk typing, 401 clerk typist. And almost immediately, the commanding general at Fort Leonard Wood glommed on to me and wasn't going to let me go for further training anywhere else. And apparently he got overruled, and I was shipped from there to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, to be shipped over to Germany. And I did some work waiting for shipping orders there in the general's office. And the more work you did, the more work they brought. And it became obvious that you couldn't overcome, you know, you go through four file drawers of work and they bring in two more four-door files. Shortly after I got to Fort Jackson, I had taken the competitive exam for West Point in high school. Totally forgot about it. My mother had pushed that. And I'm at Fort Jackson, and here comes word that I'm appointed. And so what do you do at that point? I knew nothing about what West Point was. I'd really forgotten about it. And I'm getting shipping orders to go over to Germany. But the next order that came was to go to Amherst to prep for West Point. And I went to Washington, D.C. and talked to Senator Capper. I really wanted to go to Germany. I remember this was only 6 months after Germany had surrendered. But I decided that most of my contemporaries, fathers had gotten them in college right out of high school, and they had beaten the Army deal, and they were getting ahead of me. So I decided I'd go the Amherst route. So I was sent from Fort Jackson to Fort Devens, Mass., and Fort Devens, Mass. To Amherst, where I was there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and then to the military academy. Now, when I got to the military academy, I realized that for the first time that you graduate with a degree in science, engineers. And furthermore, you had to spend 4 years after you graduated in the military. And at 18 years of age, which I was, the idea of spending 4 years in the military was abhorrent because I always wanted to be a lawyer. So after Beast Barracks, I resigned and elected to complete, I think, 3 or 4 months more. Otherwise, I'd be eligible for the draft again. And got out, and let's say I got out in late November, early December. Within 3 hours of getting back to Newton, I marked up on the railroad and was headed west on a freight train to make money, because I had to put myself through school.
And if you were to tell a story about the railroad for kids, which one would you choose?
Well, I had lots of experiences on the railroad.
The Ghost of Curly Toots.
The Ghost of Curly Toot. Right after I started work, I was 16 maybe, on the railroad. From Newton to Dodge City, they were running like 60 passenger trains a day, troop trains and so forth, plus all the freight trains. And one of the stories they told me was at Overly, Kansas, there was a brakeman named Curly Toot. And Curly Toot was quite acrobatic and so forth. But Curly Toot had managed to get himself killed by a locomotive running over him at Overly. Okay, so everybody told about Curly Toot. And maybe a year after Curly Toot was killed at Overly, another brakeman had thrown a switch and gone back and told the engineer and the conductor that he'd just seen the ghost of Curly Toot. And Curly Toot had told him, be careful. And about 2 weeks after that, he was hit and killed by a locomotive at Overly. And it's easy to get killed in the yards on the railroad because cars will run and not make any sound. And if you're standing on the tracks or in the middle, why, they'll get you. A lot of people were injured on the railroad or killed. But anyway, I'd heard that story. I was on a troop train that was empty, 26 cars of empty cars, no lights on them. We had a double-headed steam locomotive, and we were running at least 120 miles an hour. And I'm on the rear end, and the conductor's on the front end. And I'm a flagman at that point. You have to wear a uniform on passenger trains. And just as we got to Overly, we go into emergency. And you could always tell when you were a flagman when you went into emergency, because the air would make a sound like going, shoo. That means all the air had disappeared, had been let out of the brake cylinders, and the brake cylinders operate in such manner that the brake shoes clamp onto the steel wheels to exert emergency braking pressure. They put flat spots on the wheels, and that's terrible. Well, anyway, train stops. I've got to go back and see what happened. So I'm walking along. I get back towards the crossing, and I step on something, and I put my light on it, and here's this dead guy on his elbows, halfway sitting up, totally dead. I said, excuse me. And there's a big yellow moon coming up at that time. Within 10 minutes, I'll bet there were 200 or 300 people there at the scene, everybody wanting to look at the dead man, wanting to borrow your lantern to look at the dead man. He had work boots on, and white socks rolled down to the work boots. You hit sheep or you hit cattle, and the reaction is precisely the same as human beings. All the surviving cattle come running as fast as they can. mooing, making all kinds of sounds, and the same thing on sheep. Reaction of cattle and sheep around death, sudden death like that, is just like people anyway. When we finally get cleared to proceed, I have to sit back there by myself at 16 in the dark, thinking about what I'd seen. That was memorable.
How about the time there was the bridge washing out? Isn't that where Curly Toots like save the day?
No. Go ahead.
Are there other Curly Toots stories?
No, that's the only one I know.
What about the time that a manager?
You know Crystal Toot at Great Bend?
Yeah.
Has to be one of the relatives of Curly Toot.
I would imagine.
Go ahead.
The manager who tried to get L.O. to start work early by asking him what time it was.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The supervisor who came by and said, what time is
no,
it?
No, that wasn't L.O. On the railroad, the train and engine crews felt that they were the Santa Fe Railroad. And we really had nothing but contempt for the so-called officials. To be an officer of the railroad at that time, the lowest form of official life was really the train master. And the train master would have a male clerk or secretary. Wherever the train master would go, the male secretary would go taking shorthand. I mean, they were inseparable. The train master would become promoted to assistant superintendent. Guess who took his place? His male clerk. And we had a term for the male clerk's office that was not very complimentary. But it's like capillary action. From top to bottom in the railroad, the management was ex-male secretaries. And so we really had contempt for them. The people I worked with on the railroad, the engineers and firemen, for example, at Newton, which was a great basketball power, these guys would go to college, some of them all Americans. They come back and go to work on the railroad as brakemen or firemen. And the engineers were like airline pilots and the conductors. And, you know, you go through a town in a huge locomotive, everything has to get out of your way. It's a big, powerful machine. And everybody waves at you, like so. But it, the officers, they, as part of their duties, would try to pull tests. And if you didn't pass the test, you got demerits for it. And if you got 60 demerits, you got fired. I had a conductor named J.J. Fitzpatrick. J.J. Jerry was about 6'4". And on the night local, you had the youngest fireman, youngest engineer, youngest brakeman, because it was, 16 hours a night. And I remember Jerry, when I first started to work, he'd say, get that switch breaking, do this breaking. You do it, you had no idea what you were doing or why you were doing it, but you did it. Jerry and I are getting ready to go east on the mail train, which we ran about 130 miles an hour. At that time, you get mail anywhere in the United States in 3 days because we picked up the mail on the go and so forth. And there was a little half of a car for passengers on the mail train. And it left Dodge City at 12:15. And we went on duty at 12. Jerry and I are standing around there, and there's probably 15 or 20 other railroad people there. And the train master walks up. And he looks up at Jerry. He says, Jerry, what is the number of the current time card? That's a test. You had to know the number of the current time card, which everybody knew. Jerry looks at him. Up and down. Reaches in his pocket, pulls his watch out. And he studies his watch. He says, Mr. Smith, he says, it's 50, meaning 11:50. He says, we go on duty, he says, at 12 straight up. He says, why don't you come back and ask me that question then, if you know what I mean? We love that. We love that. I had another deal. We were on Red Ball Freight, 42 it's called, and you ran it very fast from L.A. to Chicago. And always it would leave Dodge City about going east about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, and the Santa Fe crossed the CRIP, Rock Island, at Burton. The main line, Santa Fe, is a big main line, and the Rock Island was not very big. But anyway, if there were trains coming on the Rock Island, it would throw a red board, which means you got to stop for the Santa Fe. But that was a favorite place for the officers to pull tests. And when you hit a red board there, you had to stop. You'd go over. You'd take your key, and you'd key over. You'd wait 10 minutes for it to be red. If no train appeared, then you could go ahead and flag across. And you hated it because here you are blowing, going, and you got to stop. I was on a freight car with Harry Tudor, a way car, with Harry Tudor and Johnny Edwards. Johnny Edwards has been an All-American basketball player. And so here we are stopped. Edwards comes walking up. And he says, "What have we got?" I say, "I'm waiting to see if there's a Rock Island train before we fly across." He says, "Where are they?" I said, "I think they're over there." Officials, because I'd seen a hat down among the weeds hiding around a box. He picks up a rock. He says, "Can you hit that over there?" And he throws a rock. And I pick up a rock and I throw it. And pretty soon we're throwing rocks over there, hitting the hell out of them. But under the rules, they can't divulge that they're there, and we just rocked the hell out of them, which was kind of enjoyable.
Now, you also shot a rabbit once from a train?
Yeah. On the branch lines, you carried the Wells Fargo box. That is registered mail and so on and so forth. And always a pistol there, dating back to the Wild West days, where you were, in effect, a Wells Fargo agent. And one day we're on the branch line, the track is terrible, and the cars rock and roll and so forth. And I think it was with Johnny Edwards. He picks a pistol up, he says, "Can you hit that rabbit out there?" And he fires, and the conductor fires and misses it. And so it's my turn. And the thing's rocking and rolling, I fire. The damn jackrabbit jumps up about 6 feet, I'd hit it and killed it. And they say, "That's the greatest shooting I've ever seen. There's another one." I said, "No," I says, "I hate the destruction, the wanton destruction of game. One's enough." I couldn't have done that again in a million years.
Well, you should also tell the story about how you discovered gravity.
That's a good story.
Yes.
I was riding on the what we call the doodle bug, which ran from Newton to Kinsley and back again. And it was sort of a diesel electric car. Where you carried passengers, but you also dropped off to outfit cars various supplies along the way. And that ran about 105 miles an hour. Everything done on the railroad is done pursuant to order, written orders, and you pick them up on the fly. Okay, my written order out of Hutchinson was to drop off 600 pounds of ice at milepost like 301. For a bunch of track workers who were Mexican. They had their bunk cars on the, what they called the house track and so forth. Now, Mexicans ordinarily didn't move very fast on the railroad, but they did all the track work. To dump off the ice, the engineer's supposed to slow the train down to 5 miles an hour, and you got the door open and you shove out this 600-pound cake of ice. And so we're flying along, and I'm looking at the order. I've got the door open. I got the 600 pounds of ice there. And milepost 301's coming up, and we're moving 105 miles an hour. And he's not slowing down. I look at the order. It says 600 pounds of ice, milepost 301. Here's milepost 301. I shove it out. I'd made an A in physics in high school, but I never really thought about the practical application. You know, Newton's laws, a body set in motion will remain in motion until acted upon by some exterior force. That thing goes out, Mexicans start to run. I've never seen them move so fast in my life. And of course, we're going away and the ice is moving a little slower. So I'm watching all this. And in my mind's eye, I can still see that even today. It hit a switch stand, just totally demolished the switch stand. Finally hit the ground, and Mexicans are running. I've never seen such movement in my life. Hits the ground, skips up into the air again, goes right through an outfit car, and out the other side. Mexicans still running for their life. And after it went through the car, I don't know what happened to it, but it was still in a block at that speed. I put that train order in my cap, in the rim of the cap, and it would have stayed there for years in case it was something developed on it. I had the evidence that I had maintained that. Well, anyway, I learned a lot about physics at that point.
Well, you should also tell the story about how the bell that's in the house, what's so special about that bell?
You haven't seen it, have you?
A big train bell.
What's it look like?
A train bell. Locomotive bell.
Is it the kind you clang or the kind you
huge one?
No, huge. It's a bell. This bell was given by the president of the Santa Fe, or the chairman of the board of Santa Fe, to a guy who was National Republican committee man for Kansas. And Guy Josserin, his daughter was a roommate of Betsy's in the Kappa house. Well, anyway, Guy died. And his son inherited the bell, and he didn't give a damn about it, and we had litigation. And he decided that when it was over, I could have the bell. Now, this bell has an illustrious reputation because back in 1906, a guy named Death Valley Scotty walks into the Santa Fe agent's office at L.A. and tells him that if they can get him from L.A. to Chicago in 40 hours or less, he'll pay him $10,000. In gold. If they can't, he doesn't have to pay him anything. So this wager became news coast to coast and tremendous amount of newspaper publicity. And the first engine, they had about eight engines, I guess, along the way of pulling them. But the first engine, I think, was the 40-something, rather, like 4010. On the flats, you use a high wheel engine because you get more speed out of it. When you're in the mountains, you use smaller wheels because you want traction. This bell was originally on a locomotive prior to that time, it was like a 1000 series, small engine. The engine that left L.A. pulling Death Valley Scotty was the 4010. And the bell on every locomotive it's been on, the number is stamped into the bell. Anyway, they got Death Valley Scotty from L.A. to Chicago in 39 hours, which was the fastest anybody ever contemplated. And that's the bell we've got at Great Bend. Every railroad had a bell with a different sound, and the same thing on whistle. And I can hear a whistle, like in the movies, an old movie, and I can tell if that's a Santa Fe engine or another kind of engine, because they were all tuned to different frequencies. I never realized or even thought much about it, but when I worked on the railroad, it was the golden age of railroading. Mm-hmm. We had the chief and the super chief and the El Capitan, and I think they ran from Newton or from Chicago to L.A. in 36 hours. And you know, you talk about the bullet trains, Japanese. We ran those 130 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And they were luxurious, and everybody traveled on them. Mm-hmm. Hollywood stars could not travel on airplanes. They had to travel on those trains. And as you girls know, I got to run every steam locomotive Santa Fe had. My father was an engineer. Everybody knew I was going to college, so they all got a big kick out of letting me run the engines, starting them up, stopping and so forth.
What's it like in an engine room? What do you have, a steering wheel?
A steam engine?
Yeah.
No. The wheels keep you on the tracks, the flanges. But it's a...
We have that on videotape.
On a steam engine, it's a great art to start one, because if you try to start one too fast, you'll pull the drawbars out. And that's an enormous mess. And then braking is another art, because if you do that wrong, you'll break up the train.
What was the scariest trip you ever took on the train?
Scariest? I never considered them scary. It's the fastest I ever went. You know, the locomotive at Great Bend?
Were you in a blizzard or anything?
Oh, yeah. But blizzards, the tremendous wind would slow you down.
Hmm.
And you'd be traveling 15, 20 miles an hour. And the cars would be bent over by the wind.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I worked in the winter, like Christmas vacation, or Thanksgiving, I would... here's the way I dress. Most of the trips were at night. Wool underwear from the Army. Then a pair of wool pants and a wool shirt from the Army. Then khaki pants and a khaki shirt from the Army. Then I'd wear a sweater and then a greatcoat.
And you'd still be cold?
No, not really. It's great to work out in blizzards in very cold weather when you're warm. But it's very cumbersome to do it. But that's the way I dress for wintertime.
I have here, tell about the day you fell off the train.
Fell off the train?
Sleeping. You were sleeping. Or that you didn't fall off, but you probably should have.
Yeah, to this day, I'll never know why I didn't. I remember I'd average maybe 4 hours sleep a night. Particularly, I would take my vacation in college... the railroad, the hours and time I'd accumulated through the summer, I'd take the vacation for Christmas holiday. Well, everybody wanted off at Christmas holiday, so I'd work and be paid double because of the vacation deal. And sometimes I'd never go to bed during that time. I'd be back and forth on passenger trains, so the Dodge and so forth, make a lot of money. But totally sleepy. And I was on a train called Number 9, and it was about 2:30 in the morning. And one of the things a flagman has to do is on every curve, open the door, look out to make sure that there's no hot boxes that's going to cause a train wreck.
What's a hot box?
Hot box is the axle is bathed in oil. And it rides on what they call a brass bearing. And it has cloth waste strings soaked with oil to keep it lubricated. But sometimes the oil would dry out, or there wouldn't be enough oil, or the string would get caught between the brass and the axle, and would set fire, and then friction between the brass and the axle would heat up the axle, and the axle would turn white hot, and then it'd spool out and break off. And then you have a train wreck, and you really had to watch out for hot boxes. And so you would look out for that, and you'd signal the engineer, and he'd signal you, meaning that neither one of you had smelled or seen a hot box. And you could be awfully sleepy, but you'd still wake up for every curve. I mean, you knew every curve on the railroad. Well, on Number 9, they had old-fashioned passenger equipment where you had a full-length door that you had to open. And then you'd have what they called a vestibule, a platform that you could hit a button and the platform would come up and people could go in and out. But you'd stand on the platform and you'd reach out and you'd hold the grab irons, which went straight down, and signal. And, you know, you're running 100 miles an hour or better. So, very close to Hutchinson. We're on the curve, I think, at Plevna. And I'm leaning out, and I've got my lantern. And I recall signaling the engineer. And the next thing I realize is that I'm on a series of curves. Well, there's no curves like that at Plevna. And I'm leaning out. My lantern's gone. But I'm leaning out. And suddenly it hit me. We were coming into Kinsley. And for over 60 miles, I had been leaning out, had dropped my lantern, had been leaning out, sound asleep. And what kept me from collapsing or pitching out at that speed, I'll never know. But when you realize what's happened, the adrenaline goes wham, 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 wham. And for 3 or 4 minutes, you're really alert. And then you go back to the other status. But at night, a brakeman without a lantern, is you're totally lost. And, you know, I still have dreams, even now on occasion, of having lost my lantern at night. But what kept me from going out, I'll never know. Now what?
Oh, I was going to, what made you become a lawyer? Why did you want to be a lawyer, of all things?
My mother talked about me being a lawyer from the time I was in grade school. She had 3 brothers that were lawyers. Mm. And once I started debating in the 8th grade, and in high school, I always intended to be a lawyer. Always. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
when you got out of law school, didn't you work on the railroad still a little bit?
Well, you know, most kids get out of law school, they immediately go into the cram courses mm-hmm. to take the bar. Mm-hmm. And instead of taking the cram course, I marked up on the railroad. And I think the bar was like the 1st of July. And I'm out of law school late in May. And so I worked on the railroad to make money. Mm-hmm. And read my notes and so forth at night.
Now, why did Eva want everybody to be lawyers? Something about land lost in New York City?
Well, her brothers became lawyers because, according to the story, one of Abe's ancestors had owned a lot of property in New York City. I guess the name's on the title. And it been lost to taxes or something illegally. So they all became lawyers because they were going to reclaim all that super valuable land in New York City. And Ira didn't know the nature and extent of being a lawyer, but I understood they went to court and they had juries and so forth, and I thought I'd like to do that.
And did you marry Betsy right out of law school? Or before you were out
no,
of law school?
No, the year before.
A year before. And when was Deb born?
In August of 52.
When you were, had started as a lawyer.
Started practice, right.
Where was your first shingle hung out?
Great Bend.
All by yourself?
No. I practiced with my uncle for 6 months. And they had a backlog of cases that were bad cases that I tried. And I won them all. Mm-hmm. And I was paid $300 a month, and I really wasn't particularly happy for a whole lot of reasons at that firm, so I pulled out after 6 months. On April 1st of 1953, started on my own, mm-hmm. and from that year, first year, I tried 30-some jury cases, mm-hmm. a lot of drunken driving cases. I won them all.
Now, when go ahead.
I won them all. The next year, and I started representing insurance companies. And the next year, I tried 40-some cases, won them all. And by 4 or 5 years out, I was trying over 50 jury cases a year and making tons of money.
Now, what's the story about Betsy taking your files and studying them to systematize things?
By 1960... What do we have? 4 kids. And I was constantly in court. And Betsy suggested that maybe she could help. I couldn't understand how the hell she could help. She didn't know anything about law. And so she kept insisting maybe she could help. And I ignored her. And finally she said, well, let me go through some of your closed files. And so I let her go through some closed files. I remember my first 4 years of practice, I didn't have a secretary. Mm-hmm. And in 1956, I was making $70,000 a year net with no expense. Did all my own typing. I got an audit by IRS, and they told me the reason they had audited was they wanted to see how anybody could make that kind of money with no expenses. They came down to Great Bend. Well, anyway, she spends about 2 months reviewing the files and finally comes out and says, you want to see how you practice law? And she showed me when I'm dictating because I'm good, that I'm doing those things because it was routinized. I'd memorized it. And I was simply following the routine and all the analysis. She said, now, we can train somebody to do these things for you. You don't have to do them anymore. And you can do creative things. Well, I said no. Then I began to think about it, decided I'd give it a shot, and we hired Kay Holman, whose husband was superintendent of schools. And once I started using someone to type, I had to hire another one. Two full-time people, Ruby Fletcher, to do the typing I'd done by myself. Pretty soon, we're using six non-lawyers per lawyer. And, making a tremendous amount of money. The American Bar hears about this lawyer in Kansas that's doing it this way, so they sent out a group of people, and they decided they wanted to go with the national program. So I was chairman of the new committee on legal assistance, paralegals today, to develop the national program for the American Bar. For 7 years, I did that. And what do we have? 300,000 or 400,000 paralegals today doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's generally considered that Betsy and I are the progenitors, the people that started it all. Okay, what else?
What gives you the most hope about the future?
Hope about the future. Well, if I were a betting man, I taught history in college when I was going to law school. But if I were a betting man, I would say the 21st century will belong to the Far East. Japan, greater extent to China, Southeast Asia, India. And the reason is that they still have very strong family values. Education is very important to them. And they're strivers and achievers. And they got pretty good IQs. And in America, as less emphasis is placed on that, we will drift down and become a second-rate power in the 21st century. Because ultimately, education, striving, intelligence is what makes a people. And we are obsessed with material things. And our kids, for example, go to school, and for a lot of them, it's a chore. And if they can get out of it, cut classes, or not concentrate on their studies, and certainly not do homework, it's wonderful. In the other countries I talk about, education is viewed as a great opportunity. And the kids are told by the parents, you go to school, you go to school to learn. The teacher's there to teach, you will listen to the teacher. And the family expects this, this, and this from you. And the future, mankind, I think the gravity will shift to that part of the world where it's been before. So for the future of mankind, I think that we'll continue to learn, to seek after knowledge and so forth. And I don't like the nuclear weapons. The great powers will never use them. But rogue powers and terrorists will use them. We'll see them used.
And what gives you hope in all of this is what?
Well, I think mankind will continue to advance in knowledge. And in the overall scheme of things, whether the United States is on top or China's on top is totally immaterial.
And what advice would you give to your grandchildren about
what?
They can...
Education. To get... to seek after the truth and gain great educations.
Then on the other side of these kind of things, I think every marriage, every family goes through times that are easy and times that are hard. What do you think has been the biggest reason that you and Betsy have made it through even times that are hard?
Well, let's put it this way. We really haven't thought about any other alternative. You meet challenges and problems as they come, and you do your best.
And what do you like most about her today?
Betsy, as both of you know, is a very hard worker. and she hasn't learned not to work hard. Even today, as a matter of fact, she puts in too much time even today on things that she could let go.
And what do you like most about her today?
Well, basically what I liked about her 40 years ago, 45 years ago.
Which is?
She's intelligent. She's understanding. We have a great common area of beliefs and principles.
And what do you like most about yourself today?
No.
Well, can we sing the Swing Low song now?
No, we're not going to sing.
And if we sang it, we could always just cut it out.
We're not going to do that.
And I think another chapter at some point will be all the legal stories, all the silly.
Do we need to wind it up right now?
Yeah, I think so, because he has to get to his rotor.
I'll give you another railroad story. I came home for Thanksgiving vacation, and I mark up, and I go out on a wrecker. It had a big wreck just east of Larned. And you have to go clean it up. There were about 20 cars had gone off the tracks. The general manager had come out in his private car, and he had a chef in white uniform, and he had a couple of porters and so forth, and very, very cold. And I was with this Johnny Edwards and Harry Tudor. Harry died last year at 105. But anyway, it's hard work, and we're out, and it's cold and so forth, and the general manager's in his warm car. And it's just turned dark, and he and some of his other officers are starting to sit down for their evening meal. And as I walk by, the kitchen is right there. And they had 6 filet mignons and 3 cherry pies. And unfortunately for them, they had a box there. And something got into me. And I whip up there and I get the 6 filet mignons and the 3 cherry pies. And the engineer, fireman, conductor, and 2 brakemen ate very well that night. Now, I was a hero on the railroad. That went up and down the line of what I had done. And I was a hero for that. Okay?
Anything else you want to say?
Now, it's a funny thing. When Mother died and we buried her at Newton, I go to the graveyard, and surrounding them are all these names that I worked with, people that I worked with. And, you know, you think of them, as young as I was, as pretty young people. They're all dead. And there's their tombstones, and you think of all your interactions with them. One day I was trying a case out at Kinsley, and we had a 2 or 3 hour intermission. And so I decided to go out the graveyard there. And I'd heard of all these people Mother and Ello talked about when I was a little kid. And I go out there, and there the names are of all these people that were their friends. And she had a friend named Louise Petitclair, which I thought was a funny name, but it's French. And there was her tombstone, Petit-Clerc, means little clerk in French. But here's all these people.
All their friends.
Her relatives.
Around them too.
Yeah, it's kind of poignant to see all these people, her relatives that lived at Kinsley, and all the people that they knew when they were young.
You told a story once. Do you still believe this really happened? After Ello died, you went to stay with grandmother and the rocking chair. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I don't believe in ghosts and that type of thing. But I will say this, that I'm asleep and I hear rocking going on in the living room. And it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So finally I decide to get up and see why she's out there rocking. And I go in her bedroom and she's sound asleep. And I go out, and this platform rocker is still in motion and comes to a stop. Now, that's the closest thing I've ever come to the paranormal.
Did you love your dad a lot?
Well, in the context that you probably love your father, fathers are authority figures. You know, I worked with him on the railroad. I was the only one who understood what he did, why he did it, and how he did it, and so forth. Forcing us to go to church, I hated that. God, I hated that. And stopped it as soon as I could. I thought when I was a little kid that he was being suckered by these religious people. And I was really ashamed of him for letting it happen. But one thing, though, that the religion deal did for me, it taught me how to spot phonies at a very early age.
You told me once that he told you that he loved you.
Just before he died.
So?
The only time he ever said that in his life.
And so what, you'd gone to visit him in the hospital?
No, 3 weeks before he died, he was at Newton. And I'd been in Wichita, and I had Chase with me. He was just a baby. And I stopped by, and I was shocked to see his condition at that time. And tried to get him to come to Great Bend, because I wanted to get him out of the dark house. And he didn't want to go. But as we went out, he came out and told me that, which I had never heard in my life. That's the last words I had with him.
Hmm. You think he knew something at that point?
Oh, sure. He knew he was going to die.
Yeah.
Sure.
How about your mom? She loved you quite a bit, and you knew that.
Yeah, she was a tremendous, hardworking person. Mm-hmm. As a little girl, she grew up and she had all these brothers. And from the time she was 5 years old, she had to take care of them. Change the diapers, all the drudge work. They lived out in the country. You have to realize that, she was a very pretty lady. But she never had a doll or toy of any kind from the time she was born to the time she was married. No birthday cakes, no nothing. She had a dog named Watch, which I learned after she died. You know, she had written in her memoirs about her dog Watch, and her horse was Pet. And she, very, very hardworking.
What do you remember the most about her?
Well, as a child, you go home, your mother's there. That's important.
She baked you lots of cookies.
Well, I remember in 1930, I was in the third grade. That'd be 1933, or 34, Valentine's Day. I came home, and the sun was shining through the windows, and you had lots of sunbeams going. But when I came home, she had baked a bunch of cookies and had hot chocolate there for Valentine's Day. And that was a very good feeling, which I remember to this day.
Mm-hmm. That surprise.
Pardon?
That was the surprise you were kind of hoping for.
No, I hadn't thought anything about it. Mm. But she, she was a great cookie baker, and she was always home. And you had a sense of security. Mm-hmm. Okay, shall we call it?
Yep.
Today?
It has to be a whole new chapter on the legal days, though. Names of people in Kansas. Larry Stinkle.
That's
all
true.
Those people.